closing arguments are heard in the Stevens trial. Now it's up to the jury. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 21st of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Tlingit Elder Dr. Walter Sobolev gives words of wisdom as he turns 100 years old.
Take care of the old person you're going to become. Here I am.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
Senator Ted Stevens, honorable and decent public servant, or a man who thought he was above the law and got caught? Jurors in Stevens' trial heard two very different versions of the 84-year-old lawmaker today during attorneys' closing arguments. Both sides called this a simple case, but pushed jurors to reach opposite outcomes. APRN's Libby Casey is covering the Stevens trial and joins us from Washington this evening. Hi, Libby.
Good evening, Lori.
Libby, first of all, would you please describe the scene and how the day unfolded for jurors?
Well, this was a chance for the lawyers to speak directly to the jury. So they faced them at a podium, and that was really their audience. The closing arguments lasted all day. It started with the prosecution, and then it was the defense's turn to try to prove that the government had not made its case and that Stevens is innocent. Then at the end of the day, the prosecution got the final word for about an hour. So it lasted pretty much from 9:30 in the morning until 4:30 in the afternoon, and I'm sure jurors went home with a lot to think about.
What did the prosecution start with?
They began with Stevens' association with Bill Allen. They said Stevens had a good friend in Allen. He knew he was wealthy, generous, would help him, and would give him hundreds of thousands of dollars in free benefits. The prosecutor said Stevens knew his other friends in Alaska, who've been mentioned in this case, were trusted and loyal and would cover up for him. Prosecutor Joseph Bettini said the price is always right when it's free. And he described this as a simple case about an elected official who received gifts and concealed facts. And he just systematically went through the alleged gifts and tried to tear down Stevens' own logic. And Bettini kept repeating the word nonsense. It was nonsense that Stevens' friends would go out and buy him expensive things like a grill, toolbox, a fish sculpture. But then Stevens says, well, they aren't really mine. These items are just at my house. Bettini said nonsense. Also that a massage chair doesn't really belong to Stevens. It's just a loan. And then Bettini pointed out a $3,000 stained glass window that Stevens says was really a gift for his wife is still a problem because Stevens is supposed to declare gifts that are given to his spouse on these financial forms as well. Towards the close of his arguments, Bettini played a tape of Stevens for jurors, and this is a wiretapped phone call made in 2006 between Stevens and Bill Allen when the investigation of Allen was breaking. Jurors heard this earlier in the trial, and Bettini used it again as a reminder. Here's what they heard.
You got to just stand back and say, what's going to happen when it's all over? You got to get a mental attitude that these guys can't really hurt us, you know? They're not going to shoot us. It's not at rack. So what the hell? Worst can happen to us is we run a bunch of legal fees and might lose, and we might have to pay a fine, might have to serve a little time in jail. I hope to Christ it never gets to that, but I don't think it will. But I mean, I'm developing the attitude that I don't think I did anything wrong, so I'm going to go right through my life and keep doing what I think is right.
Bettini said that didn't sound like someone who hadn't done anything wrong.
Libby, how did Stevens' lawyer fight back against that?
Well, on a couple fronts. First of all, attorney Brendan Sullivan said that tape actually shows Stevens is innocent. He doesn't talk about renovating his house for free. He doesn't talk about gifts or hiding things. He's just trying to comfort a friend. Now, one thing to remember, Lori, is that Stevens even says in this tape that they're probably being recorded, so he was probably careful about what he actually said. Otherwise, though, Brendan Sullivan tried to show the absurdity of these charges, saying that after 70-some years of abiding the law and serving the public good, the government claims that Stevens masterminded this big conspiracy. Sullivan said the government was guilty of looking at life through a filthy, dirty glass, and so seeing the whole world dirty. He also kept talking about the government being guilty of sick thoughts. So he was really trying to get the point across to jurors that this is just sort of crazy. Sullivan focused on a letter specifically that Stevens wrote to Bill Allen in 2002 asking for an invoice. And in this letter, he says, "Friendship is one thing, but compliance with the ethics rules is entirely different." The jurors probably have this letter memorized, and it's amazing to see how both sides are using it and coming up with entirely different interpretations. Sullivan says it's an honest attempt to get a bill. And he really cast Bill Allen in an ugly light, calling him a liar who's only trying to say what the government wants so he'll get a lighter sentence. He said Allen was a real problem for the Stevens couple because he kept doing things for them they didn't want. Bottom line, Sullivan said, Ted Stevens is a simple guy, and this is a simple story. He wanted a home where his grandkids could visit and spend time, and Bill Allen was the one out of control.
Did Senator Stevens' lawyer mention the character witnesses who testified for him?
Absolutely. He reminded them that Colin Powell and senators from both major parties have vouched for him. Remember, Colin Powell said Stevens is the kind of guy you want to take on a long patrol because you trust him so much. And they said Stevens' reputation is sterling. Sullivan kept trying to plant seeds of doubt in jurors' minds, even saying, you know, you don't want to look back on this in a week and think, I trusted Bill Allen over Colin Powell. He kept reminding them they need to feel the government has proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And he wrapped up by urging jurors to do what's right.
And Libby, how did the prosecution drive their points home in that final presentation?
Well, Brenda Morris is a lot more intense and bold than the prosecution's prior speaker, and she started with, wow, were we at the same trial? And showed that she has a different take on this. And she said no one is above the law and that Stevens is blaming everyone but himself, blaming Bill Allen, blaming his wife, blaming friends who were working on the Girdwood house. She tried to relate to jurors, telling them, you know, you can't tell the phone company I didn't get the bill. Catch me next month. She said notable character witnesses like Colin Powell don't know the private Ted Stevens. They aren't driving by his Girdwood home and noticing, you know, oh, look, he's had work done on his house. So this was something he was hiding, doing behind the scenes. Ultimately, Brenda Morris told jurors to stand up to Stevens, and in her words, few people have done that. She said they should look past his, quote, growling and snappy comebacks and righteous indignation and see that he's just a man who needs to take responsibility. So both sides laid it on thick for the jurors, who I'm sure have a lot to think about tonight.
APRN's Libby Casey is covering the Stevens trial and joined us from Washington, D.C. Jury deliberation will begin in the case tomorrow. Today at the Elders and Youth Gathering that precedes the AFN Convention, First Alaskans Institute trustee Byron Malott spoke about the incredible legacy of Tlingit elder Dr. Walter Sobolev. Sobolev will turn 100 years old in November, and Malott said introducing him was humbling.
Walter Sobolev is a man whose life has spanned a century, one of the most challenging, laden with opportunity, and most changing centuries that Alaska Native peoples have ever lived in or witnessed.
Malott says as a young man in Yakutat, he remembers listening to Dr. Sobolev on the radio.
The whole village tuning in to their transoceanic radios. Remember those big transoceanic radios? And waiting to hear Walter Sobolev from his church in Juneau provide us a sermon in Tlingit.
When Dr. Sobolev rose to speak, he stood easily, like a man quite a bit younger than his 100 years. He spoke directly to the young people in the audience and said that Alaska Native ancestors had something more precious than gold.
And that something more than gold we call in the Tlingit language, Tuhusatsin, a strong mind, a strong mind. They wouldn't let the cold kill them. They wouldn't let the long walking kill them. If they were walking, somebody would holler out, Yigo'ayakon, Yigo'ayakon. Have courage. Be determined. Don't stop.
He said Alaska Native people were here because of the courage those ancestors had, and he urged young people to follow that example of courage.
Have you ever picked it up and put it inside you? If you do, it comes very quietly. It makes no noise. But when you pick it up and it comes into you, you've picked up something wonderful.
He said another important quality to adhere to is the truth.
Young people, pick that up and let it become a part of you.
Dr. Sobolev said there is value in learning the simple word no.
There are many things in this new generation from the Western culture. Many things, good things and bad things. Against the bad things, young people, say no. No. No.
He said when he was in the first grade, a teacher said to always take care of the old person you are going to become.
And I thought to myself, gee, what a funny talk to give us. But I never forgot it. It was one of the best messages I ever heard. Take care of the old person you're going to become. Here I am.
Dr. Walter Sobolev, speaking to the elders and youth gathering today in Anchorage. He will turn 100 years old in November. The full version of his talk today will be available on our website, aprn.org. A motorcade transporting Governor Sarah Palin was stormed by protesters in Colorado yesterday. Palin was about a half a block from the venue of a campaign event in Grand Junction when a group of demonstrators charged into the street. Grand Junction Police spokeswoman Kate Porras says protesters disobeyed officers' instructions to stay out of the road.
We had a group of demonstrators who were on the corner of an intersection. Several of our motorcycle officers passed through that intersection, and immediately after they passed, a group of about 8 or 10 protesters ran out in front of the oncoming cars that were in the motorcade and attempted to stop them.
Poor says officers had to dismount motorcycles and physically remove protesters from the road.
It was quite a dangerous situation, not only for the protesters because they had moved in front of those moving vehicles, but also for our officers who had to put themselves in danger to try to get those protesters out of the way. And it also created a security threat for the motorcade itself.
Poor says no officers or protesters were seriously hurt and that the governor, who was traveling several vehicles back, was unharmed. She says the rally was held as planned without incident. Grand Junction police are reviewing video of what happened to try to identify protesters and possibly make arrests. Poor says it's unclear whether the demonstrators were affiliated with a group. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, looking at the state's renewable energy plan.
If we'd have been on hydro already for years, our economy, our people would have all been better off.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com.
Alaska Energy Authority Executive Director Steve Haginson today gave legislators a preview of the statewide energy plan he's been working on since he was given the assignment in March. He told the Joint Renewable Energy Task Force that after talking to utilities, communities, native groups, and the public, there has been no shortage of ideas.
Almost everybody in the state has a plan on what they want to do. I'd like to coordinate them all at some point. I have a deadline of December 1st to get this all pulled together. I will hit that.
He says his mandate is to save money for people's energy needs using local fuel and sources instead of diesel for heat and electricity. Local sources can be anything from hydro plants to wood. And Haginson says along with that comes a stronger economy. As an example of the cost of energy, he said Selawik right now spends $2.4 million a year for energy needs. He says Fairbanks loses $460 million each year.
If you could keep all of that work using locally available fuels in your economy, it would be a huge boon to the economy. You'd have local jobs. It would allow for some wealth retention in Alaska instead of sending all of our money south to Lower 48. It would help us reduce our energy costs, but reducing the amount of fuel and delivery and all the infrastructure it takes to deliver liquid fuels.
The final plan will look at alternatives to current fuel sources and at new technology that will work in the state. Haginson says he's not looking at policy decisions or even at budget decisions beyond the cost of an individual project. That's for the administration and the legislature to work on. He says he wants to present a way to get all the energy needs in the state below the 12 cent floor of the Power Cost Equalization Program. He says that will leave the PCE as a safety net for price fluctuations as urban and rural energy prices come more into balance. Natural Resources Commissioner Tom Irwin told the panel that the energy plan has to carefully define a state energy policy. He warns that everyone could change to wood-burning stoves right now, only to find next year that the result was not what they wanted.
If we'd have been on hydro already for years, our economy, our people would have all been better off in general. So we have to be smart, and there's going to have to be a real linking of the two together.
The task force is charged with coming up with its own long-term energy plan that members hope will not be far removed from the direction the Energy Authority will take. Haginson says he plans to release his plan the 1st of December and will get feedback from various stakeholders in the field. Then in January, he will take it to the public on a tour of Alaska communities. The Board of Interior Native Regional Corporation Doyon has approved a shareholder dividend of $356 per 100 shares. Doyon annually pays out 50% of average net profits from the last 5 years in the form of distributions and contributions. The corporation has over 16,000 shareholders, most of whom hold 100 shares. Doyon dividends go out December 11th. People who can't wait or won't be able to November 4th can vote early at Division of Elections offices. Early voting began in several states, including Alaska, yesterday. Nikki Spiegel, regional election supervisor in Fairbanks, says any registered voter can fill out their ballot early.
It's designed for anybody who wants to use it, whether they're going to be not available on election day. It may be more convenient for them to come into this office instead of their polling place.
Spiegel says those wanting to cast their ballot early need to come into the Division of Elections office in the region where they are registered to vote. Early voting is open weekdays through Election Day, as well as Saturday and Sunday, November 1st and 2nd. She says early voting has been available in Alaska since 2006. Two in-state pipeline projects under investigation would bring natural gas to the interior. NSTAR is looking into piping gas from the Brooks Range through Fairbanks to Anchorage, while the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority is pursuing a line from Cook Inlet to Fairbanks. NSTAR spokesman Curtis Thayer says his company is in talks with Anadarko Petroleum about tapping the Gubik gas field in the foothills of the Brooks Range, about 100 miles south of Prudhoe Bay.
Anadarko is cautiously optimistic, but they are looking if the gas is there to justify a line. We anticipate that by 2014, 15, 16, in that time period, we could have gas flowing to South Central Alaska and most likely Fairbanks before that.
Thayer says NSTAR needs a 3 trillion cubic foot gas reserve to make the project a go. He says Gubik gas has qualities that would make it cheaper to handle.
the Gubik gas looks to be a dry gas. The tests are still being done, but a dry gas means there is not a conditioning plant that you would need if you were on the North Slope, because they have wet gas, which actually is a cost savings to the end user because it's just one less expense that they have to pay. Cook Inlet has dry gas. We almost pump it directly from the field to somebody's home without going through a treatment plant. And Gubik gas is very similar, so that's a good sign.
Thayer says NSTAR is also talking with Doyon about a gas from the Nenana Basin. He says the pipeline project is needed to make up for the declining supply from Cook Inlet. The state's Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority, or ANGDA, is betting on increased production from Cook Inlet. ANGDA Director Harold Hines says Cook Inlet can meet in-state demand if there's new exploration and development.
Just go ahead and drill more wells, if I can put it that way. I think I've heard that somewhere.
Hines says the state agency's long-planned gas line spur has evolved into a project that could run in reverse until a larger North Slope export line is constructed. The ANGDA project would run from Cook Inlet to Delta Junction with a temporary line to Fairbanks. Hines says it's a way to meet short-term demand in the interior.
The work we've done says that the best thing for Alaska, and frankly the best thing for Fairbanks, is to have the big pipeline bringing a large volume of North Slope gas through this area. But unfortunately, that's 10, 12 plus years out. And so on a fill-the-gap basis, we think as soon as 5 or 6 years from now, we could have a combination of the spur pipeline we've been working on and some plastic pipe, and we could actually bring Cook Inlet gas from the Beluga field all the way up through Glen Allen, Delta Junction, and bring it to Fairbanks.
Hines says natural gas would provide an alternative to higher-priced oil, especially for electricity generation. Hines says natural gas, unlike oil, would not be susceptible to international supply and price fluctuations.
The United States, uniquely of all the countries in the world, has a huge resource base of gas that is untapped. So every time the price goes up by some increment, then all over the United States, whether it be in Texas or the East Coast or wherever, they look at opportunities they know of. And some of them all of a sudden become economic, and that moderates the price increase.
ANGDA recently put out a request for proposals for preparation of an environmental impact statement for its $1 billion-plus gas line project. Hines says the state would share investment in the project with the private sector, and NSTAR's $3.3 billion bullet line is envisioned as an entirely privately financed endeavor.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
The Alaska Federation of Natives is gearing up this week for its annual convention in Anchorage. This year's convention themes are veterans and energy, which are both issues attracting a lot of interest in recent weeks. Many Alaska Native veterans are living in remote villages, which makes proper health care difficult. Wasilla's Morris Bailey, a Vietnam veteran, is helping other vets through a nonprofit organization called Veterans Aviation Outreach. Bailey, a pilot, flies to Bush, Alaska to bring help to veterans or to bring them to Anchorage area hospitals.
Most of the Native veterans, they can normally be seen by the village nurse or health aide, but sometimes they have problems that warrant a trip into Anchorage. And if they're not in the system, they have to pay their own way or get an organization such as ours to bring these guys in, you know, if they call us. And most of the time, they do know about us, mostly all over Western Alaska. And we do get numerous calls for assistance.
Bailey says a large number of rural veterans are not registered in the system. In other words, they do not have the records required to receive benefits.
In the system means that he has to have a VA ID card. And that alone just doesn't give him 100% assurance that he's in the system. What he needs to do is make a doctor, he or she, needs to make a doctor's appointment, be seen, and then they're fully integrated into the VA system. And when they go back home, if they have a problem, if they're in the system, their chances of the VA paying their way back in is greatly enhanced by the fact that they are in the system. But 90% of the people I met are not in the system.
Military veterans are scattered throughout more than 200 Alaska villages. Bailey says the cost of a round-trip air ticket to Anchorage can be up to $1,000, making the trip cost prohibitive to many of them. Veterans Aviation Outreach does more than fly people to the city and back again. The organization helps veterans with home repairs, builds wheelchair ramps, and helps vets file claims.
Surprisingly enough, the last few villages that we visited, there was quite a number of Iraqi veterans that have served in these villages, and 90% of them that we ran into, because we're doing Western Alaska right now, they were non-native. They were people who just simply wanted to get away.
Bailey received the state's Veterans Advocate Award for 2007. In Canada's Yukon Territory, the outlook is grim for the territory's exploration industry. The crisis in the world financial markets has already cost some Yukoners their jobs. But as the CBC's Cheryl Kawaja reports, others are hoping the slowdown passes quickly.
Things were quite busy through here, and then about the beginning of September, things have just died, you know, right off now.
Mike Power looks over a flowchart at Aurora Geosciences in Whitehorse. He says it's usually hard to find an empty desk here, but today the exploration company's office is almost empty.
Yeah, our staff varies seasonally, but we peak out at about 70, and right now we're down to 11. But last fall, for example, we still had 30 to 40 people working.
Over the past few weeks, Power says he's had calls from junior mining companies pulling the plug on projects.
Virtually everybody is shutting down. Money's being sucked out of the mineral exploration market, going elsewhere perhaps to pay bad debts.
At the Yukon Chamber of Mines, Carl Schultz says the Yukon exploration industry could lose millions over the next few months. He says if that happens, the effects are sure to impact the territory's economy.
There still will be demand for metals in the long run. I think in the short run, it's going to be a little tough.
And that's something the staff of Aurora Geosciences know all too well. The industry often wobbles, but Mike Power says this is different.
In terms of its how quickly it came on, this was the worst I've seen. I haven't seen the bottom yet, so I can't really tell.
Cheryl Kawaja, CBC News, Whitehorse.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks and Cheryl Kawaja in Whitehorse. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Alan Lockyer from Anchorage, and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Support for APRN coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from the Alaska Sea Life Center, Alaska's unique marine research facility and public aquarium. In celebration of Alaska's 50th anniversary of statehood, the Governor's Legacy Dinner will be held on November 14th at the Hotel Captain Cook. All eight of the living governors of Alaska will be in attendance for this elegant and prestigious event. Enjoy world-class entertainment, gourmet dining, and special anniversary gifts. For more information and to make your reservation to the Alaska Governor's Legacy Dinner, log on to alaskaturns50.com. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Statehood Celebration Committee.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.